I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Good design adds value to products, services, experiences, and certainly to cities. Our guests today are making their own contributions to the design of cities. Lynn Osman is president of the Chicago Architecture Foundation, a remarkable organization promoting public awareness and appreciation of that city's architectural legacy. Cy Palmier is in charge of urban design in downtown Washington, D.C. He's in the midst of improving its parks, its squares, streets, and boulevards. Design and architecture are our topics today on Smart City. We'll return right after this news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Lynn Osman is president of the Chicago Architecture Foundation. The foundation presents a comprehensive program of tours, exhibitions, lectures, special events, and youth education programs to enhance public awareness and appreciation of Chicago's outstanding architectural legacy. In 1998, the foundation was awarded the Chicago Community Trust James Brown Community Service Award for the most outstanding Chicago community organization. In 2002, Lynn was awarded the Paul Berger Arts Entrepreneurship Award, presented by Columbia College, and in 2005, she was recognized as an honorary member of the American Institute of Architects. Before joining CAF, Lynn spent 17 years running major performing arts companies in both Canada and the U.S. Lynn, how did Chicago acquire such a rich collection of architecture?
Well, I always use the comment that we burned down at the right time. And, you know, as we well know, we had the Great Fire of 1871, whether it was Mrs. O'Leary's cow or whatever it was, you know, the city did burn down. And when we burned down, it was right at the time a lot of new technology had come into play, and that was we finally had the elevator. We had metal frame construction. We had terracotta for building fireproof buildings. We had plate glass so that we could build larger windows. And then we had, you know, heating and ventilation systems that were much more sophisticated. We also had a very small amount of land because of our lake and because of our river of where we could actually build. And so thank goodness that William LeBaron Jenney, who is the father of the skyscraper, was one of the founding fathers of the skyscraper here, because he'd been a Civil War engineer and had built bridges. And so when you think of the technology that we had for building bridges, he simply put that up so that we could build tall buildings. And so he really invented the first tall building. And out of that really sprung the Chicago School of Architecture, which we still know today. And it was that very simplistic look where we have not a lot of decoration, moving away from the Beaux-Arts kind of very highly ornamented European design. And we had a whole school of architects who came after him, whether it be Hollibird and Root and Burnham and Atwood, who really built together a very strong school of Chicago with that stylistic of that tall, simple, elegant high-rise. And then from there, of course, we went to the World's Fair of 1893, which really put us on the map in terms of 27 million visitors coming to Chicago just in that year that it was being held. And people really came here to see what that time was the Manhattan Building, which was 16 stories, and at that time it was the highest skyscraper in the world. And then we evolved into really the Mies van der Rohe School with the international style that, you know, started happening with Mies coming over in 1938 to be the head of the IIT campus and the school of, at that time it was the Armour Institute. And we really evolved this international style. So once again, the Chicago School became the international school, international style, and swept the world. You know, there were Miesian buildings throughout the world, and it was because of the influence that he had here. And thank goodness, we are fortunate enough to get the former director of the Bauhaus to really make an influence on Chicago. And now it's encouraging to see what's happening in the city because we've really had a rebirth with the mayor's vision for Millennium Park and Frank Gehry coming in and doing that and really seeing the effectiveness that wonderful architecture makes in terms of building a community and building the tourism base. Now we're really seeing a lot of skyscrapers sprouting up in the city and a lot of residential skyscrapers in the development community and the architectural community is really flourishing.
You mentioned Burnham, and of course Chicago has the great Burnham Plan. To what extent do you think Chicago and other cities are shaped by good plans versus good architecture? And what's the interplay between the two?
I don't think you can separate. In order to have good architecture, you have to have a good plan, and a good plan is not effective if you don't have good architecture. So they're really, the two of them go hand in hand. And the Burnham Plan of 1909, and we're already planning the celebration for 2009 of 100 years of the Burnham Plan, really based a great foundation for building the city of Chicago as we know it today. And I think that really, you know, makes it so that we can have great planning and a great city. We're one of the few cities that has a lakefront park, and I think we can thank Burnham, but we also have to thank Montgomery Ward, who really, you know, brought lawsuit after lawsuit on people as they tried to build buildings in the park. And every time you or I, you know, walk in that park, run in that park, we realize how fortunate we are to have this phenomenal front yard that most cities don't have. So that really is an icon for Chicago, and that's because of great planning. But also, you know, with our world that we're dealing with density and all the other issues, sprawl, and that, you know, is really such a planning issue, and we really have to see how architecture combines with those.
Tell me about the role of the Architecture Foundation, specifically the Chicago Architecture Foundation, in terms of both encouraging good planning and good architecture in the city.
Just to go back a bit on who the foundation is, we've been around for 40 years. Next year, 2006, will be our 40th anniversary, and we were originally founded to save Glessner House, which is a historic house by Richardson on the south side of Chicago. Out of that evolved an organization that had people passionate about the architecture of Chicago, and we formed a very, very strong set of docents. Now those docents used to give tours of Glessner House, and now we've separated into two organizations, a historic home organization, which is Glessner House Foundation, and then the Chicago Architecture Foundation. Our story is talking about the city and educating people about the city so that they can make the best decisions about their built environment. And we use the word built environment because, again, you can't separate architecture and planning. And we do that through offering tours of the city. We have 440 volunteers, and they give 88 different tours, and that's over 8,000 tours annually of the city. And that's to residents and to tourists, and it makes it so that people can understand. They look at a building, they can read a building, they understand some of the issues. When we give our modern tour, for example, one of the big things that we talk about is about density and about zoning and the issues that come across there. And then also we have our adult education programs that are phenomenal. You can take a course on sustainable design, about urban planning, architecture vocabulary, and in the night of the week. Or you can also, of course, do a lunchtime lecture that talks about Calatrava's building in Chicago. And then we also do a lot of issue-related Chicago debates so that we'll talk about green design, which is a big thing for not only Chicago, because we have a mayor who wants to be the greenest city in Chicago, but also, of course, for the whole country, as we really want to get engaged in what's going on with the whole debate about sustainability and how do we make it so that buildings, which are the highest polluters in the world, it's not cars, it's buildings, and how do we make those buildings so that they, you know, don't pollute our air and our environment. And so it's really quite exciting that we can have these wonderful debates and these wonderful discussions about Chicago, but also the world of planning and design.
How do you account for the fact that you have enough interest in the city, both among the residents and the tourists, to fill up that many tours and that many programs a year?
Well, I think we're fortunate that we're in Chicago, and I mean, we always talk about the biggest pastime sport isn't the Bears or the Cubs or the Sox. It's really architecture. And even the taxi driver will give you an opinion about a building, you know, whether it's an ugly, attractive, or what he thinks of it. And we know our buildings by names, you know, so that they have a personal. They're not, most of them aren't 333 Wacker. They have the Rookery building, the Monadnock building, so they're like a member of the family. And I think that people in Chicago, you have to be passionate about the buildings because they're part of our family. People come from across the country really to visit Chicago because it's the quintessential American city, both in terms of the Midwest feel about it, but also our skyscrapers and, you know, our Frank Lloyd Wrights and our many different other contributions to the architectural landscape. And I think that we are fortunate that we have that automatic base here and that almost cult status, but then I think we've just really done a lot in terms of educating. I mean, just our tours alone bring in over 200,000 people, and through all our programs, it's 600,000. I mean, those are phenomenal numbers for architecture junkies, but also just people in general who are curious.
Do you know what percentage of those are residents versus visitors?
For our tours, of course, it's about 80,000 people are residents and the rest are tourists. And then for local programs, most of those are the residential market, whether it be our exhibits. We just did an exhibit on green architecture, or whether it be our, you know, adult and youth education programs. And we also have a very comprehensive youth education program in schools. We've developed a K-8 curriculum, and we're now working with Chicago Public Schools to develop a design curriculum that has been introduced in the high schools this year for grade 10s and will be introduced in grade 11 and 12 next year. So we're really starting them at a young age, too.
I saw that you had done that. In this day of No Child Left Behind, is there any room in the school day to actually use the programs that you've developed?
I think what is really interesting is that we've worked with teachers. They've been on our advisory team and saying, what do you need in the classroom? And they need to teach to test scores. So every one of our lesson plans teach to a test score. But it's using architecture and design to teach social sciences, to teach English, to teach writing skills, and to teach math and sciences, so that architecture and design and engineering are all really good core introductory subjects to teach more complex thought processes. And the teachers like it because a lot of children often get bored with the normal lesson plan. So these are kind of integrating something into their daily lesson, whether it be evaluating your house, looking at your block, how does density work, you know, what's the sway on the Sears Tower. I mean, so things that they get curious about. And it uses it as a core curriculum. And every single lesson talks about how it relates to other subjects, because everything has to be interdisciplinary now with the schools, and then how it relates to the Illinois test standards. So it actually is a tool rather than yet another thing they have to introduce on top of their already busy teaching day.
Are you beginning to get feedback from teachers in terms of how it's working?
Absolutely. And the most exciting thing right now is the high school curriculum that is, you know, in its first year with the test year. There are 1,500 students that are working on it this year, which is a, you know, amazing number. And we actually have a student advisory committee as well as a advisory committee of teachers. And so they're every month they're getting together and talking to us about how it was working in the schools, where should we adapt it, what the changes are. And, you know, one of the things that one of the teachers was talking about is mapping. The kids are doing some mapping exercises, and they didn't even know how to read a map, and these are grade 10s, but just taking that into their whole neighborhood so that they're becoming what we had hoped for, is more aware citizens, because these are our next voters, our next planners. So let's have them help look at our city and make good decisions.
Are you piloting that project in Chicago and expect to take it beyond Chicago?
We right now are piloting in Chicago, and then we're hoping to take it beyond Chicago because we've just formed a partnership with the American Architecture Foundation, and it's called the K-12 Architecture and Design Network. And it's looking at how do we nationalize this whole discussion of architecture and design so that we're part of the subject core curriculum that's being talked about. When you talk about the arts, often people forget about architecture and design, and yet is the most accessible art subject. Architecture is around us every day. I mean, you have to go into an art gallery often to see a piece of art, whereas every single time you walk past a building, you know, it helps you interpret and look at it and know how that affects the way you feel about your city and about your town. And so architecture and design is something that we really want to have more discussion on across the country on a national basis. And when we look at what's going on in Europe with the European Economic Community, this is a real push that's going on in the European Economic Community. Probably, you know, in America we've been spoiled because we have so much land. We don't have the same energy problems, but it's going to catch up to us, as we already know with our gas prices. So we really do have to start looking at issues about sprawl, density, communities, architecture, and planning. And this is great that we're finally getting some sort of national dialogue on it with the school children.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Lynn Osmond. She's president and CEO of Chicago Architecture Foundation. How many other architecture foundations like yours exist around the country?
We're unique in the fact that we're the only one that has the comprehensive program of tours, exhibits, adult education, youth education, and of course, our retail outlet, too. There are places across the country that will have part of that, but not all of it, whether it be the Municipal Arts Society in New York and the AIA Architecture Center in New York. They have the exhibits in some of the adult programs. They don't have the youth programs and the tours as we do. So we're actually in the process of looking at how do we help form other organizations like ours in the country, because we're always getting people coming to our doorstep saying, I just took one of your tours and I really want to start a tour program in San Diego, or I was just in San Francisco, and they're trying to emulate a lot of our programs here. So I think that we're the largest of our type in the country, but that you will see more and more of, little mini CACFs happening across the country, which is quite exciting. That whole movement of architecture centers and foundations is a growing movement.
Certainly, Lynn, the market is beginning to value celebrity architecture. What's driving that trend?
Well, I think, we can look back and say that it was the Bill Bau effect, and it was Frank Gehry with the Guggenheim Museum that really, I think, was the catalyst for it, where he built the museum. It was a stupendous museum, and people came. And, who had ever heard of Bill Bau before? But all of a sudden, it put the community of Bill Bau on the market and into the tourism range. And so I think what's happened is people realize that architecture can make a difference to a community. What's exciting with what's happened in Bill Bau is that they went beyond the actual, just the museum, is that they've really done a comprehensive plan for the city. They've, got the Norman Foster subway system, and then they've also, done all these wonderful riverfront developments that have really made a difference to the whole city. And I think that they're a model for what you can see with good planning and how it makes a difference to the morale, the city population. When we look also at another Spain example, is Barcelona has really become a model for what they've done in terms of architecture and planning with their redevelopment of their waterfront. And I think that star architecture thing is being the starchitect, as we call it. Isn't it great that finally, you can talk about Gary Daniel Libeskin like you talk about Ralph Lauren and, these fashion designers, because they are, in a fashion designer. Calatrava is determining taste by his tall, slender buildings. But now people know those names, and that architectural awareness and literacy is really quite exciting. I think the challenge for local designers is to continue to market their own services so that we just don't get, starchitects in cities, that we do get a really good balance of local designers that are riding the wave, as I would call it, of this interest in high design.
You work on improving architecture and planning in the city by elevating the citizens' knowledge.
Right.
There are other techniques that cities attempt to use, for instance, design review. Are you a fan of design review?
Well, I actually sit on a very interesting group called the City Design Initiative, and it was started by a planning commissioner, Alicia Berg, several years ago, and working with the mayor's office, and it's still in existence. I think it's been 4 years or 3 years that we've been working with the planning department, and this is something that comes up on a regular basis. We meet monthly, and I think it's probably a monthly discussion with all sorts of opinions, where the design review actually, what does it do? Does it raise the bar overall, or does it just raise the bottom so that we don't have as bad design, but does it curtail the great design? And there's no answer yet. I think there's cities that we've looked at where we brought in the planning commissioner, Larry Beasley from Vancouver, John Raham from Seattle, and then we brought in Fred Manson from London. And we had a forum with the planning department, it happened about 2 years ago, talking about, design review and how do you get great design. And I think everybody was quite intrigued with the Larry Beasley and the Vancouver model, where they do have a design review committee, and Vancouver really has the highest density in any city in America and is getting a lot of lovely silhouettes in terms of its high-rise development. And it's very interesting to see that they have a review commission that includes planning people, includes architects, includes landscape designers, urban planners, and community. And it's a very effective process. Whether that'll happen in Chicago, I'm not sure, but it's certainly an opportunity for debate.
Are there other techniques that cities use to improve the quality of their planning and architecture?
Well, I think most of it starts with a very aware planning department and a mature planning department. And I know we were sad recently to lose our chairman of the board because she's been named the new commissioner of planning. But for the city, I think it's a wonderful move when you get somebody like Lori Healy, who's a very mature person heading a planning department and who appreciates design. So it really has to start with that and an enlightened mayor. And it was interesting. Mayor Daley is quite enlightened. He received an honorary landscape award from the American Society of Landscape Architects, which was brilliant on their part, because now he gets their monthly magazine. And one of the people in the Department of Planning held it up with all these yellow stickums sticking out of it. She said, "This came from the mayor. he was so enthusiastic that he put this on my desk. And I just thought, you know, there weren't two or three. There were probably 12 stickums in this magazine. So I think, you know, having an enlightened mayor is really very important. And having corporations, I mean, that's really where, you know, one of the things happened in Chicago, of course, is that we don't have as many corporate headquarters as we used to. And that's happening in many cities with amalgamations. But some of the greatest design was because of great clients. And those clients were often corporations. And for a corporation to look at the city they live in and want to make a statement through their building and building an iconic building that really complements the city is really one of the first steps of, you know, great architecture in city design. But I'm talking a lot about high rises, but, you know, it can be even neighborhoods where people, you know, one of the challenges we all have is that people care more about the granite countertops and about the hardwood floors than perhaps what the building looks like on the outside. And I guess I can dream of a world where people say, oh, I live in that wonderful Mies van der Rohe building. And people go, oh, really? And, you know, so it's the image of your address that you live in a stately building that's architecturally interesting rather than the slab of concrete just because it has granite countertops and hardwood floors.
My sense is there's a growing interest again in modernism.
Yes.
And do you sense the same thing?
Oh, absolutely. Even I was talking to a friend of mine who has an antique store. She said, you know, antiques are hard to sell now. Everybody wants modernism pieces. So that's really kind of come even with furniture. You know, you can't really separate architecture and design and planning. So we're seeing a real trend that people are very excited about. New architecture and modernism.
And it seems as if that is even moving to residential buildings, even single-family homes, which is a real new movement in cities. Do you sense that existing plans will accommodate that sort of trend?
I hope they do. I mean, we have a long way to go. I think that people still think of the picket fence and the, you know, the traditional roof line as being the home, you know, that I want. It's okay to look at buildings downtown and having steel and glass, but when I come home, I want the very traditional brick building or wooden clapboard house. I think that we still have to work a lot with planners and developers and with new urbanists and, you know, people to really kind of change the idea of a sense of neighborhood, a sense of community can include modern structures.
Where do you take the Chicago Architecture Foundation next? You do so much already. You have such a breadth of programs, but where do you go next?
Well, a couple of the programs that we're looking at, besides our national K-12 design initiative that we're working on, is we're looking at doing a feasibility study for an architecture center here, and we're working with many partners, including the AIA, to really build a home for architecture. So when you come to Chicago, there is one-stop shopping, you know, where you can go to learn about architecture and design, planning. Landscape architecture is certainly something we're embracing, too. And to not only just physically present programs on that, but to have exhibits, really use it more like a train station where people come in, can learn from the exhibits and the various lectures, but then can get educated also with our docents on the street and look at the tours that they give and, you know, explore the city. So that's one of our personal development goals. And also trying to do a national association of architecture organizations where we can really unify all the many different architecture organizations that are happening across the country and put them all through a national program with an association of architecture organizations. And it's interesting, our firstborn, as we call it, is the Australian Architecture Organization, which we helped form a year ago. And we realize that there's many of them in various communities, and we want to unite them by having, you know, some sort of a network and encourage their growth and having a conference so that these various voices can be heard across the country.
Lynn, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you.
Lynn Osmond is president of the Chicago Architecture Foundation. After a short break, we'll return to talk about urban design in our nation's capital with Cy Palmier. And we'll talk to Otis White about the latest news on cities. You're listening to Smart City. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Otis, one of the great social trends today is the presence of singles, the delay of marriage by young people, the increasing rate of divorce, and the resulting number of people who are simply living alone in cities.
Yeah, and we've located them all. They live in Manhattan. It turns out, for someone who's been married as long as I have, I've been married for over 30 years. I got married as a child, of course. And for someone like me, it always comes as a surprise to find out how many people not only are single, but actually live alone. That is, they're not cohabitating with someone else. They live alone. And as it turns out, Manhattan, the borough of Manhattan, has the highest percentage of single people living alone of any urban county in the country. And again, we're not talking about single but having a roommate. I mean single as in that's just you and the goldfish and the dog who live there. Now, a good question is, so why would New York have so many people who live alone? And the answer tends to be in the kind of folks who are attracted there. New York attracts a lot of people in their 20s who've just graduated from college, haven't had a chance to get into a serious relationship with someone. They're ambitious, they're workaholics, and they're attracted to New York. And New York has some unique features that are particularly appealing to people who live alone. It has a great cafe and bar society, so you can always go out and meet people. It's pretty easy to meet folks in New York. And yet you can come back to your very, very, very small apartment and have complete privacy there. Now, it's also important to say that New York has, not only does it attract a lot of people who live alone in their 20s and 30s, but they also, as it turns out, attract a lot of people who are 65 or older. Now, these might be people who have been recently divorced or widowed or just simply never married, but they are attracted to Manhattan for pretty much the same reason as the youngsters are, which is it's an easy place to meet folks because of the way that the public life works there. So in New York, you don't have to be lonely, but you can choose to be alone when you wish to, and that's very attractive for folks who don't mind living alone. There's one other sort of factor about New York that's kind of interesting, or Manhattan, that's kind of interesting, and that is because the living spaces, the apartments, are so cramped, when people do get married, and particularly when they have children, they tend to move to the suburbs simply because they can't afford a place bigger than that. Now, what happens to their apartments when they leave and they move to the suburbs? It's freed up for more single people to move in. So it's a kind of constantly replenishing stream of folks. And as you indicated, this may be in sort of a window into the future because, as it turns out, single households, that is people who live alone, is the fastest growing demographic group in America today that is sort of looked at by household formation. Grew 21%. People who lived alone, percentage of those adults grew 21% in the 1990s.
You wouldn't know it from the political dialogue, would you?
No, we don't talk about single values, do we?
No, we don't. We don't. It's an interesting trend, and again, it's one we'll continue to follow. Otis, we'll talk to you next week.
Okay, Carol.
I'm Carol Collette, and you're listening to Smart City. Cy Palmier is urban design consultant for the downtown D.C. Business Improvement District in Washington, D.C. Since 2002, he's been preparing a public realm improvement plan for the parks, squares, streets, and boulevards in the 120-block Business Improvement District. He is also senior urban design advisor with HNTB Corporation and a co-founder and principal of LDR International. He's worked in more than 50 cities in the U.S. and the U.K., and he's author of the book Creating a Vibrant City Center, published by Urban Land Institute. Cy, why are so many of our public spaces in America so bad?
Oftentimes, they're not very well designed. I think that in the last 10 years, many people have learned from the experiences of maybe the last 30 years. I mean, oftentimes spaces are not designed to really be attractive to people. They're not comfortable. They're oftentimes far too much paving. And I think that the other big issue is that good spaces oftentimes have activities, meaning various uses that are right on the space or right adjacent to the space, restaurants, outdoor markets, good retail, things of that nature. Oftentimes spaces, they don't have those kinds of uses adjacent to them. They really do not draw the people, and they certainly don't cause people to go back over and over again. Rockefeller Center probably is one of the best examples in the world of a space that people really enjoy going to.
It is a wonderful space, isn't it? It's always great to be there. Of course, it's always full of people, and just the incredible way in which the buildings come together. It's a lovely space. Let me ask you this, though. So many public spaces, you know this, are commissioned by people with absolutely no background in architecture and design and urban planning. And so, as an urban designer, how do you make them smarter about the kinds of clues they should be looking for in the work they're presented that suggests the work will stand the test of time and will be a successful place for people?
I think if you're familiar with Project for Public Spaces, an organization that really grew out of William White, who wrote a number of wonderful books about the importance of public space. And I think that in a way, many people are educating themselves. I mean, there's so much more been published in the last 10 years about the importance of public space and how it works and how we attract people to these spaces. And again, Project for Public Spaces have been very critical of things that are being built around the country, and I think that's been very helpful. They also have a lot of conferences, and I think people become very conscious of what it takes to create a great space.
It's interesting you mentioned Project for Public Spaces, Cy, because I know that they are generally not complimentary of architects, urban planners, designers, people with training in those fields and education in those fields. You think that's fair?
Well, you always have to look for the positive things. There are so many really outstanding examples in this country and outside of this country. We need to really kind of be more positive. I don't really believe being critical oftentimes turns people off, and they are very hard on designers. Maybe a lot of them deserve to be critiqued, but I guess part of it, I know who the good people are in this country and also in Europe and England. And I think that they are a lot of people doing very outstanding work today. And it is to a large degree because we have learned from each other. We've learned over the years what it takes to create a great space. I would hope they would be a bit more positive and look for just focusing on the examples that really do work well.
Is there anything new about what makes a successful public place? Or did we just forget the lessons that we should have known and that history teaches us?
If we look back in time and we look at some of the great spaces, oftentimes William White used to say that the very best public spaces are ones that really kind of reach out to the community, that have what I call really good public exposure. And there are obviously places like Bryant Park in New York where it is in fact open on three sides. It has three sides open to major public streets so people can really see into the park. There's great visibility. The fourth side, that was really the important side because that's where the restaurants and the outdoor cafes, things of that nature occur. Without that fourth side, we really wouldn't have a good public space. Like in Washington, we have Freedom Plaza, which is at the west end of Pennsylvania Avenue. It's not a good space. There are a lot of problems with it. It's elevated quite a lot above the street level. It has no restaurants. It has no activity except when there's some special event, which is maybe a half a dozen times a year.
I think I know that plaza. It has wonderful pavement, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The pavement's very special.
Right. It has a lot of famous people have quotations that are on the paving. It's very, very nice, and that does cause a lot of people to go there and study those.
But in effect, it sits between two streets. I mean, it's bordered by two streets. There are actually no buildings that front on this triangular park or oddly shaped park. Is there anything, as someone looking at the Business Improvement District in Washington and its entire public realm, I don't know if Freedom Park is within your area of responsibility, but as you look at a park like that, that is essentially isolated, what can you do to fix it?
Well, we are currently studying and evaluating that park. It is within our domain. It is, of course, the responsibility of the Park Service primarily. But we've had a good working relationship with the Park Service, and we're looking at both Freedom Plaza and Pershing Square. Pershing Square is the furthest most public space, and almost all of the parks and spaces that we've looked at and have had some improvements in are where we're trying to reduce what I call visibility into the park. Pershing Square, as an example, is a very difficult park because it's so heavily planted. It's one thing to have shade, but if you have these parks that are so totally canopied by trees, and oftentimes the trees are low branched, you don't even get good visibility into the park. There's a wonderful little water feature and things of that nature in Pershing, but people are not going there in any large numbers. So we have the public space in Washington, more of it than most cities, but a lot has to be done to make these spaces more attractive. And maybe we need to look at small outdoor cafes. There are a lot of great spaces in America where they've introduced what I call small cafes that draw people, and people then sit outside and enjoy the space.
There are many public spaces, and particularly parks, Cy, have what could be competing uses, uses that are not terribly compatible with one another. Have you confronted that issue and addressed it?
In the case of Washington, which I know best, I don't know that the competing uses are necessarily the problem. I think that because there are so few programmed activities in our parks and in our plazas, they tend to be places where the homeless tend to find shelter or spend time and oftentimes sleep in the parks at night. And I think that if you go to New York today or Boston and you look at the parks, you'll find that there's so much more happening, so much more programmed activities. And they are not having the same kind of problems that we are. They also may be doing a better job of helping and providing facilities for the homeless. I don't know that we have done nearly as good a job as Philadelphia, New York, and Boston, which are probably leading the country in caring for these things. But I don't see a big conflict. What I find is that there are not nearly enough people desiring to go to our parks. And we had concerts this year in Franklin Park, and there were great concerts, but there would be like 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 people at most. There should have been several hundred people coming out.
Well, that raises a really interesting question, doesn't it? I mean, you are essentially representing the property owners in a quasi-public fashion with a bid, with a business improvement district. To what extent should you be responding to public demand for these spaces, and then versus the desire simply to have public spaces, perhaps for aesthetic purposes or because it's the right thing to do? I mean, there's a tension there, isn't there?
I'm not sure, actually. The property owners have been extremely supportive. We've been working now for about 2.5 or 3 years with the Park Service to try to raise the level, the quality of all the parks that are within our 110-block area. And they have been very, very supportive and encouraging. The biggest problem we find is a long-term commitment or regulation the Park Service have, which is they don't believe that having a vendor that's serving food or an outdoor cafe, they don't see that as being a positive thing. In fact, they discourage it. And when you go to, I've studied a lot of the London parks as an example, they're putting in more cafes and restaurants. In St. James Park, they just introduced the most spectacular new cafe. In New York, a family gave, I think it was $5 million this past year to put a new cafe in Union Square. So there's a lot of people who are recognizing the need for activities to draw the people into these parks and make them more usable. But we have yet, you know, to convince the Park Service that that's a desirable thing, although they do offer a limited amount of food, as an example, along the mall.
It's nothing to make your plans around.
No. You don't go there and look forward to having a lunch or a dinner. Although, if you go to the wonderful new kind of small cafe that's in the sculpture garden that's owned by the museum, that is terribly successful. That's probably the best example in all of Washington where a small restaurant combined with a great water feature draws. There are more people going to that space than any other space downtown. So we know what it takes to have it work, but we're just not quite willing to go the extra mile to have it happen in other places.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Cy Palmier. He is urban design consultant for the Downtown D.C. Business Improvement District in Washington, D.C., and he's also senior urban design advisor with HNTB Corporation. Cy, you've worked in so many cities around the world. When you think about the cities that have really done justice to the public realm, that have a public realm heavily used by citizens and beloved by citizens, which cities come to mind?
Well, I think London and Paris probably are the two best examples in the world of spaces that are really appreciated and enjoyed. They also have climates that are not that different than ours. And certainly in this country, Chicago, with the leadership that Mayor Daley has provided, is probably, along with New York, probably the two best examples. If we look at New York, what it's done in the last 10 years to make, you know, Central Park was not a place that anybody wanted to go to 15, 20 years ago, and now it's one of the great parks of the world. So if we just look at the examples of New York and Chicago, which I think are the two best areas, cities, along with Paris and London, we know what it takes to make our parks and our public spaces a lot more successful. And we're also working with the developer who is in the process of planning for the 10 acres of land that was originally devoted to the convention center. We think there's an opportunity there to create a truly great public plaza, a public space, totally different from the ones that we have in our city, more like Rockefeller Center, with skating rink in the winter and restaurants and outdoor markets and things of that nature. And I think we have a developer in the Heinz Company who really want to do a great job, and the bid is working hard to try to convince them that this is really an important ingredient in that project.
You've talked about two New York parks that represent big turnarounds, Central Park and Bryant Park, neither of which were places that you much wanted to be not too many years ago. What was key to the turnaround of both of those parks, and what are the lessons that we can learn from those turnarounds?
Well, I think it's probably, in the case of Bryant Park, I think it was the leadership that people like William White gave, but it, more importantly, Dan Biederman, along with the property owners. I mean, New York is primarily about the bids. The bids have really done a great job in working via the property owners and the city and have taken over what I call the day-to-day management, the day-to-day maintenance, and the day-to-day programming. Central Park is a great example of where leading citizens in the community came together and they formed a foundation, a nonprofit foundation. They got the very best minds to work together. And again, they, I think, convinced the city that this had to be a partnership, that the city was not able to do what needed to be done. And I think that the really great examples, whether they be Chicago or New York or Boston, are really about partnerships. It's about the cities and the National Park Service owning the land, but allowing the private sector to be more responsible. We have to help maintain these parks because they're not being able to be maintained to the highest level. The Park Service just don't have the staff, they don't have the money, they don't have the means to do what needs to be done.
But if we had the public will, they would have the means to do what needs to be done. And I'm curious because, I mean, there seems to be response from the private sector to support parks at a new level, and yet government support for parks seems to be in decline. So how do you reconcile those two things?
Well, I think the point you made earlier is that there needs to be a more of a, not a groundswell, but we're trying to organize over the next 3 to 6 months. The bid is trying to organize leading citizens in the Washington area to really care deeply about this and become more vocal. And we probably need to go to Congress because even our mall, which is one of the most sacred pieces of land that we have in this country, is not being cared for very well. And they tear it up every year for the various festivals and things, and it never gets put back. I mean, the festivals are wonderful, but they ought to be created and used on the edge of the mall, not in the middle of the mall. And the Smithsonian does a great job of bringing thousands of people downtown to these festivals, but in the process, they end up destroying the mall, and the sod and the grass just completely gets ruined every year.
You know, I completely agree with you. I hope you're successful in that because I think the condition of the mall has seriously deteriorated, partially in response to security concerns and how that manifests itself physically. But also, as you say, I mean, the turf is not what it used to be. I mean, there are these incursions into the mall itself, and it's really not as grand a space as it once was.
Absolutely. It's being used not too hard. The interesting thing is the large gatherings of people, like on the 4th of July, people sitting on the grass, going out there and kicking a soccer ball or throwing a frisbee. None of those things damage the grass. I mean, if you go as an example, probably the best example in all of London is Hyde Park. Hyde Park just is so heavily used. When you go out there on a Saturday or Sunday, there are thousands of people doing all kinds of recreation. But they never dig up, the middle of the park and, you know, put in all these kind of festivities and plumbing and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So we know what other people are doing and how they're doing it well. And we just need to, I think, convince the public officials in both the local and national government that we have precious space in the city and we need to do a better job of caring for it and maintaining it.
You've used the term several times during this interview, bid, and I've used it. Why don't you describe what a bid is for any listener that may not know?
Well, the Business Improvement District idea grew, I think, probably 10 or 15 years ago. Now there are hundreds in this country. And what they are really is that the private property owners pay an additional tax per square foot of office space or retail space. So the property owner literally pays an additional tax, which is collected by the local government, and then that money flows back to a private sector nonprofit corporation, which is composed of primarily a board of directors made up of usually city and private sector people. So the money is paid by the property owners to the city, and the city in turn returns that money to a nonprofit corporation for the purposes of marketing, maintaining, hopefully keeping our streets very clean. That's one of the really big things that's changed in Washington, is the streets are much cleaner, and so it's about security, safety, and maintenance.
What does it say to you, Cy, that government is not able to do this on its own?
I think really the demands on the public sector are so great when you look at all the infrastructure problems and issues related to roads, transportation, utilities. All of these things are such heavy, heavy responsibilities, the social services, all the things that we ask our government to do. And I think it's probably not possible that they can also do the level of cleansing and caring for our cities. It's interesting now, the English and the Europeans are now going to the same idea of the bids. All over England and Europe, they're now beginning to set up bids. And it's the same issue. People want in downtown to have a higher level of service than can be normally provided by the public agencies. So rather than being critical of the city or being critical of the National Park Service, what we need to do is recognize that we can be partners in helping them do a job better.
When you think about public spaces and the decisions, again, that clients, if you will, public or private, have to make about the design of spaces, if you could give us two or three tips, things that, you know, would keep you in the right road, if you will, in the, you know, moving in the right direction with public space, what are those guidelines?
Well, I think probably the single most important thing is the quality of the public space itself, the care that we have for that area, because beautiful parks throughout the world, because they are cared for and beautiful, in and of itself attract people. So I would say first is the quality of the maintenance and the basic design of the park. And secondly, I'd say it's the need for certain activities within the park, whether it be, you know, programs or festivals or dining. We have to have more things happening within our parks to draw the people. And I guess third is just being extremely sensitive to the issues related to the homeless and things of that nature, because they need to be cared for also. We can't just say, let's say, push them out of the parks. They have a right to be able to use the space too. But what we find is in really great parks, people who have less means come and enjoy those spaces with everybody. But it's because there are lots of people enjoying the park. They don't stand out. They're not a problem. But in oftentimes in our parks, we end up having a concentration, certainly in off-peak hours, in the evenings and weekends. We have a very, very large number of people that are congregating in our parks and not really allowing other people to enjoy them.
Cy, thanks for talking to us about the parks in the nation's capital. I appreciate it. I'm glad you could join us on Smart City today.
Thank you very much.
Cy Palmier is urban design consultant for the downtown D.C. Business Improvement District. City View's commentator Walker Smith says holidays are for coming together and renewing connections through tradition.
In my family, holidays are no vacation, especially Christmas. My mother is in her late 70s, yet she still cooks a full-blown feast for 12. Turkey, smoked ham, yams, butter beans, green beans, broccoli, yellow rice, gravy, dressing with onions, dressing without onions, slaw with onions, slaw without onions, oyster casserole, squash casserole, grapefruit salad with pomegranate seeds, tossed salad, cinnamon rolls, biscuits, iced tea. It's the same menu every year. Everyone looks forward to it, but it's a lot of work. My mother accepts help only to serve it and to wash the dishes. She also sets the table and leaves a small surprise at each person's place. My parents' house gets decked out for the holidays. My mother prefers Christmas trees that are 3 or 4 feet in diameter at the base and 7 or 8 feet high. The tree is always sagging from the weight of her lights and ornaments. My youngest sister lives nearby, so she spends a few days with my mother decorating the tree. My father stuffs the stockings with nuts, fruit, and gifts. He also hangs the garland and puts out the outdoor Santa and lights. Presents get wrapped and cards get mailed. For a few weeks, there is always a holiday job waiting to be done. On Christmas Day, my oldest sister celebrates twice. First, with her family and in-laws. Then, after a big Christmas lunch, she and her husband pack up their 3 girls and drive 3 hours to my parents' house, where more presents, more Santa Claus, and more food await them. My sister attends church the night before, after which she has Christmas Eve dinner with her husband's extended family. After setting up Santa Claus and packing, she gets about 3 hours of sleep before rushing through 2 tours of Christmas Day. My wife and I try to arrive at around the same time as my sister, but we're always late, so I've got a collection of Christmas Day speeding tickets. My holiday responsibility is handing out the presents, which in our family is done 1 present at a time so that everyone can enjoy each surprise. With 12 people, this takes 2 or 3 hours, during which time camera batteries give out and have to be replaced, forgotten presents are remembered and hurriedly wrapped upstairs, and inevitably something burns in the kitchen and has to be doctored or replaced. Christmas Day isn't over until 9 or 10 o'clock that night. Even then, there are always a few pots and pans that take longer to clean, mostly, I think, so that my mother can spend time talking with my wife in the kitchen while everyone else crashes on sofas and chairs all over the house. Every year, we resolve to simplify our holiday celebrations. But every year, we go through the same stress and strain all over again. After all, it's our tradition, our way of coming together and renewing connections. It is strenuous, but it feels familiar and safe. Holidays may be no vacation in my family, but they are definitely worth the work. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich Partners. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to hear Smart City Broadcast, sign up for podcast, listen to archive shows, and register for our weekly newsletter. Our theme music was composed and performed by Memphis musicians Robbie Grant and Steve Selvage, with additional music provided by Christopher Reyes. Candace Ludlow edits Smart City. Smart City is a production of WKNO in Memphis. I'm Carol Coletta.
National distribution of Smart City is made possible by the listeners of WKNO in Memphis and by the Hyde Family Foundation, investing in enlightened leadership, transforming the future of children and community.